So the topic tonight is how sex is changing technology. Our speaker is Annalee Newitz, and you've got a couple of sites maybe that sort of touch on this topic. Maybe you could talk some about them and sure. Go ahead and get it started.
Okay, so as Scott said, I'm a policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation out in San Francisco. So I'm also going to be, during this talk, wearing one of my other hats, which is I'm a journalist, and I have written a lot about sex and technology. You might have seen, if you read Wired magazine, I had the article last month about the technology of reading women's orgasms in their brains. So it was women being put inside fMRI machines and having orgasms, which was a really fun article to research, although I didn't get to go into the machine and have orgasms because I'm not that talented. So, but I also have written a lot about the relationship between the internet and erotica and pornography. And I even actually wrote an article about trying to have sex with a stormtrooper at Dragon Con several years ago. So I don't know if any of you saw that, but apparently it was a little controversial. Although the stormtroopers were not upset about it, so I don't know why anybody else was. But the answer to the question that you might be wondering is no, me and my friends did not get to have sex with a stormtrooper. So, because none of them wanted to do it with their uniform on. So, and that was our stipulation. we only want, come on, I mean, it's sex with a stormtrooper. You gotta have the uniform. What doesn't count if.
Okay, so why didn't they want to keep it on?
Well, it has to do with the crotch hinge. So you can just go lack of crotch hinge. So yeah. So you can go ahead and ask. Yeah. So you can go ahead and ask the troopers yourself for the answer to that question. But at any rate, so aside from talking about some of that stuff, especially about looking at how we can use technology to measure female orgasms, which I think is actually quite interesting. I'm going to talk a little bit generally about how sex has changed technology, and then I really hope that, I mean, I'm like alone up here, so I really want to invite you to join in and talk and, you know, say what you would like to say, ask questions or whatever, because otherwise it's just going to be me talking, which would be really exciting for me, but maybe not so exciting for everybody else. So one of the reasons why there's obviously a fundamental connection between sex and technology is that technology is just another tool. So, and for human beings, tool use is a really fundamental drive. It's part of what makes us human. It's part of what helped us evolve into the species that we are now. And obviously, sex is very fundamental to what makes us human. In fact, fundamental to what makes us an actual life form. And so I think that those two drives, the drive to make tools and the drive to have sex, often have been coupled with each other. And there's actually a really interesting book called The Mating Mind, which is all about how humans used sexual selection to become better and better language users. And there's actually a connection to tools in there. The author's thesis is that basically, you know, how sexual selection works, right, is that, you know, people choose who they have sex with, and that obviously influences the evolution of the species. Hi, it's the people from upstairs. Yay, people from upstairs. So the theory goes that when people were choosing partners way back, say, 100,000 years ago when humans were first developing language, that they were more turned on by people who could, you know, put the moves on them by telling jokes or having a good line and by entertaining them with speaking. And so that we kept having sex with people who were more and more able to use language, and then people kept getting better and better at language, and so we gradually evolved to the point where we are now, where we all use language more or less to get laid. among other things we do with language. But I mean, it is a, you know, I mean, being able to make jokes and being able to talk help, believe me, in getting laid. So I saw that you had your hand up, but I'm gonna say one more thing and then I'll let you talk. So the way that this is connected with tool use is that a lot of anthropologists now believe that the development of language and tool use are connected, and that as we learned to use complex tools, which is to say tools that had more than one piece, like not just like a little flint blade, but something that was like a blade attached to a stick, which is called a compound tool, that actually enhanced our ability to put together compound ideas. I bet you didn't think I'd be talking about evolutionary biology in this discussion. No. But at any rate, so I think that, so at least for me, That idea that somehow sexual selection, which is all about who you want to fuck, basically, right? I mean, because that's when Darwin talks about sexual selection, that's really the point, is it's all about how who you want to fuck determines the future of the species. So to the extent that that's bound up with an affection for language and an affection for people who are good with tools, it makes sense that sex is connected to tool use, and that sex somehow changes the way we use tools. So that's my kind of highfalutin beginning to talking really about internet porn. All right, let's cut to the internet porn. But it actually is something interesting to think about if you're interested in the evolutionary biology part of this, that people are sort of attracted to other people based on how well they use tools, which is, again, why geeks get laid all the time. Or not, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, it's why I always want to have sex with geeks. So, and I just realized this is being taped and put out on the internet or somewhere, so that's great.
You'll be very popular.
Yeah.
You've got lots of dates.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. So the kinds of technology that sex has influenced tend to be communications technologies, like computers or telephones or telegraphs, and also technologies that enhance our bodies. So, for example, everything from like the vibrator, which allows you to be able to, you know, create a sensation that you really couldn't do with your own hands for very long, to other things like cars, which enhance our bodies by allowing us to go across town or across the state to get a date, maybe. Or a car also, of course, lets you have a private place to go to have sex. And also things like phones, which are also very much associated with sex. Those are a communications device, but they also enhance our ability to basically listen. So these are all devices, and I bring up this sort of wide range of devices because all of them have been associated with sex. Phones are heavily associated with sex, and actually I just saw my friend come in who will tell about that maybe a little bit. phones are very, people have phone sex, phones are very erotic. And cars, of course, are associated with sex. Everybody knows the whole thing about the phallic car, but of course, you know, the car substituting for someone's dick or for their whatever other part they might want to be enhancing. And of course, cars are a great place to have sex. And of course, vibrators are obviously sexual. The other way in which sex influences technology is to, and this gets to the internet porn part, is people traditionally have used technology to enhance privacy and anonymity when they're accessing sexual material. And that's been one of the reasons why internet porn has always been on the cutting edge in terms of developing new technologies for media consumption online and for helping people gain access to whatever kind of fetishistic porn they want, because there's that illusion that when you're online, you're completely in private. Certainly you're physically in private if you're doing like what I do and you go into your room and you pull up your porn. So no one else of my roommates necessarily knows the porn that I look at, but of course we all know because we're educated that it's not really that private out there on the internet. It's very easy to find out what you're doing, and the website that you're visiting has your IP address. Unless you're using Tor, so you could learn more about Tor at tor.eff.org. which is a tool that enhances your, I'm just putting in a plug for my organization, but it's actually a software tool that will, in fact, provide you with anonymity online. So if you want to, sadly, it is not Mac compatible yet. However, we would love to have somebody develop something to make it Mac compatible. So, but it is Windows and various Unixes compatible. Yeah, I know the Mac people always lose out. So at any rate, there's this sense of privacy online, and there's also a sense of anonymity as well. Unlike with, say, video cassettes, which are another technology which was very porn-driven, lots of adult industry companies and porn companies, you know, started using video cassettes very early on because, of course, people were sick of going to porn theaters and jacking off with all these other people. They wanted to be able to do it at home, right? You know, where it's a little bit more cozy and you don't necessarily get spoo on you from the guy next to you.
Ask German how bad that was.
Yeah, poor Pee-wee. Maybe he had a fetish for it, I don't know. But at any rate, so you know, so video cassettes provided that kind of a certain amount of privacy because you could bring your porn home with you. But you still had to go to the video store, and so the person at the video store knew that you were the guy or the girl that rented like every copy of like Buttman or whatever it was. So, or that you were like a huge fan of like, you know, Taboo 1 through 12. The internet, of course, provided that extra layer of anonymity for people in the sense that you believe that you can just sort of visit any website you want and you can go to mcstories.com and no one's going to know that you like mind control porn. And, you know, not even the person at the video store is going to know that, although maybe the guy who runs the website will. So those are the kinds of areas that I see sex influencing. Like I said, sort of communications technologies, body enhancement technologies, and privacy and anonymity enhancing technologies like the internet. And again, this is somewhere that sex has been very pioneering. Many of you may know that the vibrator, for example, was one of the first electrified technologies. So people had been doing kind of freelance jobs, you know, jacking women off for science during the 19th century without the aid of vibrators. But when vibrators came along, it made it a lot easier. This had to do with the fact that during the 19th century, it was believed that many women suffered from a disease that was called hysteria. And it would make them act really nervous, and they would faint, and they would freak out. And it was discovered by a number of doctors that somehow, if you massaged their vaginas until they reached a crisis point, that they were a lot calmer. and so this was, imagine that. And this was widely adopted as a form of therapy. There's actually a fantastic book called The Technology of Orgasm by Rachel Maines, which goes into this. And she's an academic, and it was published by Johns Hopkins University Press. And she went back and found a lot of the documentation about this.
So they thought it was a point, and the word orgasm just didn't come into their vocabulary?
At that time, it was not believed that women had orgasms.
Right.
Change because, in fact, during the Middle Ages, it was believed that women couldn't become pregnant unless they had orgasms. So it wasn't as if, you know, it wasn't as if no one really realized women had orgasms until the 20th century. It was that there was a transformation in people's understanding of how women's bodies worked.
So you bring women to orgasm, she's pregnant. Therefore, if you don't want to have more kids, you don't bring your wife to orgasm. But you can
that was the belief in the Middle Ages. So, and then in the 19th century, the belief was
that's still active, though, in some of the Middle Eastern countries. That
really?
Is still active. Oh yeah.
The idea that you have to well, that's a little bit.
If she gets pregnant, and you didn't think she had an orgasm, she obviously faked not having an orgasm.
Right. Exactly. So it's a way to feel good about yourself, right? You know, it's like, well, she became pregnant. She must have had an orgasm. You know, whereas the 19th century had a much more cruel vision where it was just that, you know, men enjoyed having sex but women didn't, which is such a weird, you know, tragic way for men to think about women. But that was the sort of mainstream belief. Of course, there were people who... It was
yes.
a mainstream scientific belief, actually. Oh. It really was among doctors. There were doctors who knew that that was crap. And there's definitely evidence that some of the doctors who were doing vaginal massage knew what they were doing. But a lot of them actually, you can't study vaginal massage anymore. I know it's tragic. in fact, I urge you to next year at Dragon Con, Vaginal Massage 101. So Eva's going to teach it. But so actually, the reason why the vibrator was developed and why it was such a popular early electrified technology was that it's really frickin' tiring to do vaginal massage all day. So yeah, tell me about it. I know, carpal tunnel, everything. So these So basically, it was a therapeutic tool. And some of the early vibrators were really hilarious. Like, they had a steam-operated vibrator that was this giant table and, you know, kind of made a puffing noise. And you can just, but I mean, but it was very, it was a relief for the doctors because they could, you know, do more clients a day, and it was quicker. And gradually, you know, vibrators became used, you know, more and more. They got smaller. And gradually, in the 20th century, they kind of went stealth, and they became massagers. And women could buy them in women's magazines, and they were kind of a camouflage technology, which is to say it sort of masqueraded as being something else. And you still see that now, right? Everybody knows the Hitachi magic wand massager is really just for women to jack off. So, I mean, you all know that, right? Okay. Now you know. It's like, why are they so popular? There's also the little fukuaku, like, finger massagers. And again, massagers, which actually maybe it would be great on your temples. I'm not sure. I've never tried. but I can guarantee you that they're good other areas. So... actually the idea of camouflage technology is kind of interesting for sort of sexual uses of technology because for a sexually repressed society, if you're going to have a piece of technology that's going to be used in a largely sexual way, you know, you want to call it something else.
God forbid we all come.
Yeah, no, it would be terrible.
And in Georgia, you have to call it, it's a novelty. I mean, and it says on the, you know, you go into the store and they'll have a sign that says, you know, this store, these are all novelty products not intended for sexual use.
Yeah, exactly. You
have to say novelty because of the stakes. They're not going to have just a set of vibrators that they only send to Alabama or Georgia because of novelty.
Right, yeah, there's some states that still do outlaw dildos and vibrators, so yeah, the novelty item is good for that. But I also think that saying novelty item makes people more comfortable, too, and they feel less like they're buying, you know, a sex thing, and more like they're buying a novelty item, which sounds a lot...
Well, that comfort level is because of the pressure of society to make it a dirty thing.
Yeah.
Well, also, like, I know from going to Tennessee Youth Legislature in high school where you're a mock senator that masturbation is still illegal in Tennessee. So, like, I can, so is oral sex and sodomy. So, like, that's why it has to be sold.
The sodomy is not.
The sodomy law was changed in 1996.
Okay. That, but I think the other
and
stuff
also
is
the
still
Supreme
the
Court recently ruled that sodomy laws, sodomy is compulsory. That's right. Yeah, that'll be the last ruling from that Supreme Court. They recently overturned all the state sodomy laws. So yeah.
You wrote about that in high school?
Yes, there was bills about it. High school students were writing bills about things like that.
That's the high school I needed to go to.
Was there another comment or?
So you mentioned about mind control porn, and I was hoping you could talk more about how the internet has made sort of fringe sexualities and fetishes more kind of mainstream or helped them to develop into subcultures of their own.
I mean, that's a common observation that the internet, which is, I suppose you could claim that the internet itself is a kind of camouflage technology, since so much of what goes on, so much of the backbone of internet content is pornographic. And indeed, pornography was one of the first uses that people made, even back in the sort of Usenet days of yore.
Bulletin boards.
Yeah, bulletin boards were great. And we all remember like the early days of GIF files. I don't know if any of you, ASCII Prawn. How many people remember what Prawn is?
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
The Giphy girls.
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes I feel embarrassed when I go to like a hacker convention and I say ASCII Prawn and they all look at me like, what? you didn't have streaming video? Whoa. So back when I was a wee lass and I was downloading porn, all we had were ASCII characters. And so that meant that when you wanted to have a pinup girl, you took and printed out this huge file, like with your, you know, with your printer feed, with your dot matrix, and you'd get like your... Yeah, about 20 feet, and in fact, they even had punch card porn back before I was using before I was using computers. So, but I have it on good good authority from Craig Newmark, who runs Craigslist.org, that he had punch card porn. So
that's a very dedicated file server.
Yeah.
Tell you what.
So I think that as the internet evolved, though, away from the punch card prawn, that it has, because of that illusion of anonymity and the illusion of privacy, it's really allowed people to explore all kinds of sexual options and all kinds of sexual fantasies. And certainly, I mean, that's the appeal of using a communications medium to deal with sex, because as I was arguing earlier in my sort of diatribe about evolutionary biology, there's a real link between language and communication and sex and how we have sex. And that's one way in which the internet has, and being able to communicate over the internet has clearly changed the way that we have sex and the way that we think about sex. Yeah.
Do you think that the internet is adversely affecting that evolutionary trend?
Mostly because before the internet, when people were interested in languages and whatnot and getting hooking up, you got pregnant. Now that you're the internet, you got cyber sex, no pregnancies involved.
People used birth control before the internet, so you didn't have to get pregnant.
No, I realize this, but I mean, you always had that chance. Now you've got sort of the elite people, based with the skills and whatnot, who are having essentially non-penetrative sex as far as the internet goes.
Mm-hmm.
Could we literally be breeding ourselves out of it?
I don't think so, because I think that a lot of people are still having babies, and I think lots of people who use the internet have babies. So I don't think
less people having babies is not a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing that's really great about cyber sex and internet sex is it does make people think about the fact that, guess what, PV sex, and when I say PV sex, I mean penis vagina sex. So you all know what I'm talking about. So it's like P/V, like K/S. So when you have PV/sex, that's not sort of the beginning and end of sex, right? And that's one of the things really that the internet teaches, is that first of all, you can have totally cyber sex, which is just sex with words, which is really frickin' hot. For those of you who've done it, you know. Those of you who haven't, I highly recommend it. It can be really, really fun, especially, you know, with people that you know, but even with people you don't know. I mean, and there's actually people, it's funny because people have sort of these boundaries with cyber sex. Like, you know, some people just cannot get turned on if the person they're talking to isn't grammatical. I'm actually one of those people. Like, if people are just rampantly using, like, you know, like you, the letter U, you know, you are really hot, you know, that kind of stuff. I can't, and it's the same thing if I'm reading a piece of porn, like on Alt Sex Stories text repository, and it's just, if somebody's just talking all about, like, titties and like they're misspelling everything, I'm just like, no, I can't get excited. Like, I'm sorry.
The sign of a true writer.
Yeah. But I think I'm not the only one. So
it's still part of the mating process, though. You pick your mate by how intelligent compatible you are.
It's true. No, I think that is part of the mating process. Yeah, because I'm sure there's somebody out there who loves people who say titties and misspell everything. So there's a person out there for you. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. You know, everybody has their own taste. So where was I going with that? Yeah, maybe we should take a question, because I actually can't remember what I was saying.
when you were talking about the evolutionary biology just a second ago, let me ask a nerdy question. So when you said that sexual selection was based on tool users, is that like a direct selection, like, wow, he makes a hot spear, or an indirect selection, like, well, his spear is better, so he brings home, you know, more mammoths for dinner?
It's probably, yeah, what are we talking about here? It's like, damn, his Unix box is hot. Look at all the tools he's got. damn, he's modded his Xbox. Okay, sorry, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I love a modder. I think it was probably, I mean, so sort of anthropologists and evolutionary biologists think that it's probably a combination, right? So in some ways it might have been very direct, like say you could really turn a phrase well, and so that might attract more mates, but it might also be, yeah, you make a good spear, therefore you're bringing more food, and therefore that's you know, better for making a family. But again, like we're talking, you know, 100,000 years ago or 80,000 years ago, you know, so it may not work that directly anymore because, of course, we're not living in a state of nature where, like, your Unix box helps me have food or something. You know, although, well, okay, people are going to disagree with me now. But I'm actually a firm believer that looking at contemporary culture in terms of evolutionary biology can be kind of a problem because we're so immersed in culture now. There's so many mitigating factors that it may not be necessarily helpful.
Right, that's what I was going to say. You don't necessarily get killed off by being stupid anymore either.
It's exactly, you don't get killed off for being stupid.
You don't read the Darwin Awards, I think.
That's a very small amount of the population.
That's why we read the Darwin Awards, is because it's so unusual that happens. You also don't die for being born with no legs. You don't die if you're blind or deaf or have a defective heart. So I think that, yeah, we're out of the phase where we're in, like, what I guess you could call hardcore evolution. And now we're in an era where also where sexual selection doesn't necessarily result in reproduction. Like, the people I choose to have sex with are not necessarily going to change the evolution of the species necessarily, except culturally. You know, I think that we're changing culture as much as we're changing our bodies. And we're using things like genetic engineering to change ourselves now, so which I think is great. I'm looking forward to the day when, like, two men can have a baby together through, you know, the intervention of science. I think that'll be awesome. That's just my little rant.
Yeah. One thing the internet has done for me is, you know, being naive, I learned how many fetishes are out there. And I'm thinking in particular, the Dan Savage column, Savage Love, out of San Francisco, just been educational. Do you think him in particular, but the internet as a whole, is bringing some of the more stranger fetishes more out of the closet and maybe bring, I guess, people together to hold hands or something else to, you know, maybe learn that they're not alone?
I mean, it definitely is. I think there's no question that it is. I think it's making having fetishes more acceptable because it's more common that we know about it. Especially if it's something odd, like everybody knows about the balloon fetish stuff because it's just kind of weird and cute. And so it's sort of one of those things that people like to pass around as a meme, like, dude, did you see that balloon fetish site? Because it's just so strange. Balloon fetish? Okay. There's a clown fetish. There's, like, you know, there's people who have, like, a messy fetish, like pie in the face fetish. But the balloon fetish is just, well, everything from people who just really like balloons to blowing up balloons, people who like to be inside of giant balloons. Like, there's special tools that you can buy that help you be inside of a giant balloon. Just
rubbing themselves against balloons.
Yeah, so how many people have seen the balloon fetish site? Yeah. it's going around. Now, see, just Google balloon fetish and you're going to find it. Yeah.
Okay.
But I guess to continue with that, though, I think that the fact that that people do occasionally actually have kind of conversations with each other about, like, whoa, did you see that weird fetish site on the internet? Or there's a greater awareness, but I think also because there's more visibility, even for very small fetishes like the balloon fetish or like the pie in the face fetish or the mind control fetish, you know, those people do feel like they have a community, and I think it's, again, because of communication, because they can talk to each other. I think people with unusual sexual predilections feel more, I hesitate to say this word because it sounds so cheesy, but they feel more validated. And I think that's a good thing because basically, even for people who just want to have the PV sex and go to sleep, it's good to know that there's options. It's good to know that sex that you're having is just one of a whole bunch of different things you could be doing. You don't have to stick anything into a hole. You can, like, do all kinds of other neat stuff. What?
You can do macrame.
You can do macrame, says Charlie. Thank you. I don't know about the macrame fetish, but I guess you could Google on that too. But I'd say the flip side of that, and here's the thing, I mean, here's the moment when I put on my EFF hat, which is, you know, the more that people are out in the open on the internet about their fetishes, The easier it becomes for those people to be stigmatized if the tide turns politically, which I think is beginning to happen a little bit. We're seeing a lot more crackdowns by the government on obscenity. And so I think it's important for people to remember, even as we're celebrating our sexuality online and finding other people to play with balloons and pies with, or to, you know, pretend to, I met someone recently who likes to pretend to be an airplane when having sex. So, and he found somebody on the internet to be, and I was asking him, I was like, well, so did you, I know, I was like, did you want her to be the airport? Did you want to be on an airplane? And he was like, no, we were both airplanes. And I was like, duh, yeah, exactly. I was like, that's awesome. Yeah, needless to say, he's an engineer. Yeah. But I think that that's fantastic. But I think it is important to remember, even as we're celebrating this, to maintain some anonymity if you're concerned about people finding out about your sexuality, because you're not really anonymous online. There are many, many, many technological ways to find out who you are very, very easily. It is just really crucial, I think, that people have, I guess what you could say is have safe internet sex. You know, be sure that when you're talking to people that you're not uncomfortable with, like if you're keeping a blog about your sex life, are you comfortable with your boss knowing what kind of sex you're having or about your family finding out or something like that? So I always encourage people to just remember that when you do have sex online and you participate in sexual groups online, that you may not be as anonymous as you think. So there's a person all the way in the back. Oh, you had the thing for ages, yeah.
Okay, you touched on just now a little bit on what I was gonna talk about here or ask about. Okay. There's no doubt that the internet has led to a lot of people's eyes being opened about sexual matters. I mean, God knows that I've learned about things in the past 8 years that I never would have dreamed existed before then.
Thank you, Google.
I'm a high school teacher, and I can tell you that the kids that I have in my classes now know a whole hell of a lot more about bizarro sexual stuff, you know, non-typical, than I ever did whenever I was their age. I personally think this is a good thing, but I also know that I'm not, you know, not everyone feels the way I do about this. And all of the knowledge that's being dumped out into the public through the internet about sex, it can have sort of a Pandora's box effect. And I've had this argument with a couple of friends who are psychologists. They are almost certainly convinced, and I hope they're wrong, but they're afraid that what's going to happen as a result of this is it's going to be too much information and too much change too fast, and it's going to wind up triggering another little mini dark age. I mean, if you look back at society, that's what happens with periods like this. You go through a period of rapid enlightenment, and then the people who don't feel comfortable with that rally and shut the lid on everything,
there's
and you go back to a super conservative period.
Yeah, I think that that's a tremendous concern right now, particularly, in fact, there were a couple other panels where I was discussing this with other folks. There's a lot of new regulations now about how internet porn sites have to be run. There are, you know, Gonzalez is stepping up his campaign against obscenity and has appointed an obscenity czar to go after consensual adult images and representations on websites. And actually, there's been just far more obscenity prosecutions for internet sites, particularly over the past year or two, than there have been for many years before that. So I think we are seeing a backlash. There has been a backlash already having to do with children. There have been a lot of laws passed that are aimed at protecting children who are online. There's a proposal now, the ICANN, which is the nonprofit that creates top-level domains on the internet, has proposed a XXX domain. They've actually approved it, and that would mean, you know, adult websites could be, you know, whatever, like cumsoakedbabes.xxx or whatever. For example. actually, I don't think there is a cumsoakedbabes site. I use that as an example all the time. So quick register it. But what that would allow is for ISPs to just block that whole top level domain, right? So if every adult site has XXX at the end, you know, you could have like clean ISPs so that you can, you know, the idea would be to just eliminate all the sexual content on the net. Now, I don't think that that's possible, but I think that's the idea behind it. So I know there was a guy in the back who's been waiting to talk. Right, or it just won't be an option. You won't be able to get a clean. You know, you won't be able to get a dirty ISP in your area.
The AOL is going to be so readily available to.
Yeah, you may just not. You may not have coverage from an ISP that offers XXX. So there's a guy who's been waiting in the back.
Of course, this isn't the first time this discussion has been had. I remember when Og was first drawing the first petroglyph. I said, "Man, you got to watch out what you're doing with that goat there, man." This has been a perennial question anytime new communications issues have come to light, be it the first time parcel post was created, the first time letter post was created, the first time couriers started carrying messages, even the first time funds began being transferred by paper and not by gold, silver, or in other words, physically backed goods. Any type of communication that facilitates human interchange inevitably gets pioneered by sex first, because after all, prostitutes first started taking paper money. And secondly, it's not just a reactionary period. We have yet every step ended up coming out the other side more enlightened, more free, and more with more opportunities to explore and experience our world. There's a lot to be warned about, but there's a lot more to be grasped.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that it's right to be optimistic, and I agree that it's, you know, there's a lot of great things happening, but I think we have to keep vigilant, because I think that with so much of our sexual knowledge being on the internet, it's a lot easier to control it in some ways. Yeah, there's dark nets, yeah, there's private websites, all that kind of stuff, but to the extent that we want to have a public space where people can talk about sexual issues, and with all the issues we discussed earlier with privacy and anonymity not being sort of mythological online, I think, you know, there's a real opportunity for people to be scapegoated and for there to be a crackdown. So I agree that, you know, we are becoming more enlightened, you know, in general, but they're really, you know, there's a danger that that could be taken away. So
does ICANN have the power? ICANN's got the power to create the physical TLDs. Do they have any sort of power to actually enforce them? For example, they create cumsoakbase.xxx. What's stopping them from doing the same thing? Yeah, .com.xx just becomes another domain that they own. How would you actually force whitehouse.com? How would you actually force them to go to whitehouse.xxx?
Wait, how would you force, you mean internet traffic, or how would you force?
Right, it passes it.
Oh, how would you enforce the policy? They won't.
I still have it. What are they going to tell me? I have to like register this new domain and take my other one out and move it. I mean, it's just
right.
Like,
I think that's
right?
It's just voluntary. The fear, of course, is that it will not be voluntary in the future. But right now, and I actually think that's very, very unlikely.
Right.
I think that you're right. I think that's why the whole hullabaloo over the XXX domain is kind of silly. You know, Bush has told ICANN to, you know, kind of put the brakes on it, and has said, you know, we don't want to have the XXX domain. And actually, there was this hilarious speech by one of his aides where he said, you know, we're opening up a whole new wing of the internet. You know, it's going to be a terrible, smutty wing of the internet. And it's like, what? You know, it's like there's this idea that somehow by having a new top level domain, you're opening up a new area on the internet
suddenly
that will be,
will
it'll be the red light district
yeah,
of the internet.
Right.
Yeah, and suddenly there'll be more porn, and it's like, how could there be more? so yeah, I think it's actually kind of a non-issue.
Question is, how many people have actually paid for porn in the last 3 years?
How many people in this room have paid for porn in the last 3 years? Any kind of porn, magazines, books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, come on, just porn. Okay, see, yeah, we're good citizens. We pay for porn. But how many people prefer free porn?
Yeah.
Yay! Yeah, that's what's so terrible about these new 2257 regulations that the DOJ has just implemented, because they're really going to stomp out free porn. They're basically record-keeping regulations that are very expensive and difficult. So any porn website that is in any way commercial, like even if they're just putting like Google ads on their site or selling t-shirts or something, are going to be subject to these regulations, and it's going to be really expensive. So it's just in the United States. So all your foreign porn's fine. You can get some free foreign porn, but
you were talking earlier about the risk of backlash, and certainly with the current assholes, I mean administration in power, we are seeing a certain amount of that.
Yeah.
But to take what the fellow in the back said and emphasize it enormously, there's a legitimizing effect that you see so many people who are using these services, who are communicating about it, discussing it, joining the fetish lists that you started out with. And it becomes that much harder and harder over time for any legitimate government to try and marginalize any but truly the most marginal elements of such a community, because there is the prima facie evidence that it isn't marginal, it's human. There was the concerns about, well, can you enforce that people register their porn domains under .xxx? No, of course not, because there is no universal law across the planet, and probably never will be, despite everything in the science fiction that most of us read. Yes, if you're going to be in one of those groups that's really at the edges, use Tor and watch your step. If you are particularly vulnerable because of where you work, be very careful. But for the most part, what we're going to gain over a long period of time is enormously better than what a few people will always lose in each round, this nasty game that we play.
I'm really glad that everybody seems so optimistic, because I think sometimes, you know, I live in this sort of bubble of, you know, privacy activism, kind of where I'm very concerned that a lot of this stuff is coming back to haunt people, and that they're having difficulty. But I do think that just because, say, a government crackdown won't necessarily happen or won't work, or they'll be kind of porous in terms of how it's implemented, what does happen is when you have government regulations that are threatening is that it's a chilling effect, and that people are less likely to speak out. And when you couple that with industries like the ISP industry kind of wanting to kowtow to what they perceive as people's, you know, moral sensibilities, you get industry kind of going along and saying, well, we're going to have a clean AOL. Or you get something like Yahoo shutting down all of its user-created groups, which they did just very recently, because it was believed that those were too sexual and too naughty, and that was where everybody was. Well, it was child porn, but they shut down every single one of their user-created groups in response to a problem in one group, an allegation of child porn.
All of these things are temporary.
Well, the user-created Yahoo groups are gone.
I would argue that while that is a minor inconvenience to those who subscribe to them, it is absolutely meaningless in terms of internet communication and the availability thereof.
Yeah, they'll just go somewhere else.
Precisely.
You know, he's absolutely right, because this has been around forever and ever and ever. I mean, it started, what you were talking about before, it started with the mail post, it started with the courier, with the direct, with UPS and so forth. It's just that it's harder for it to find its way, but it finds its way.
I think that's true, and I think that because of the fact that we do all have a drive to have sex and to talk about it and to share sex, that it's the ultimate open source resource. The more you have, the more there is. But I think I do think that you know, as the mail example is a great one, because Anthony Comstock, who came up with a lot of our mail fraud laws and a lot of the Comstock laws. I actually have a great book by Comstock, which is all about the terrible things that children get in the mail. And it sounds a lot like contemporary rhetoric about the internet. And he actually did have a huge effect. And so it is harder to get certain kinds of pornography in the mail. And the post office does have the power to search through your mail to look for materials that may be inappropriate.
Right.
So I think that's... Yeah, and so, but I agree that sex will find a way, and that people will find a way to have sex online and share information about it, but the government will also find more ways to regulate and to also surveil what we're doing online. So again, for most people, it's not a big deal. I don't care if people know that I have multiple partners and I'm bisexual and, you know, all these things. I really don't. I've written openly about it and I've turned it into something that is, you know, I can sell articles to Wired about orgasms, but most people don't have that luxury. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, the fact that we are vulnerable to that kind of surveillance online does have a chilling effect on people who don't, you know, get paid to write about sex and tech.
I had a question whether you think the proliferation of porn on the internet has led to more sexual crimes. Like, for instance, you see like drunk girls or something where, you know, if you're not really sure if it's consensual, or like sleeping girls on a bed naked, you know, and there's some sites where you can't really
tell.
Oh, you
mean like the sleepy girl sites and stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, and some of the more extreme bondage sites, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I have read only extremely unreliable statistics about the relationship between sex crimes and the internet, and I don't trust any of them on either side. What I do know is, speaking of, you know, people becoming more enlightened, is that people now understand what non-consensual sex is. People understand that when women say no or when a man says no, it means no. We have pretty good rape laws. We have pretty good sexual harassment laws. We have, you know, sex clinics for people who work in the sex industry where, you know, they can go and get tested for, you know, in order to act in films and that kind of thing. So I think that there's more information about sex in our culture because of the internet, there's more information about the appropriate ways to have sex and ways to have sex that will not be harmful and that will be consensual. So I'm actually pretty optimistic about that. I think that having more access to sex information leads to people being better about having sex that both partners want to have. And that when you see a site that has, say, bondage or the sleepy girl sites or whatever, that probably what you're seeing is a fantasy. There's kind of this myth, you know, of the snuff movie, that there's like movies out there that include people killing each other and stuff. And that's a myth. I mean, there's no snuff movies as far as I know.
None
has reputably been found. Yes, that's one. A good way of putting it. One has?
There was one. It was in a court case.
Okay, so there's one snuff movie, all right? I'll admit it, all right? So, but I think that basically people are learning more and more about the difference between a fantasy role play and, you know, real rape, which is wrong and is illegal.
Remember, in the 1890s, this whole thing about showing the ankles was going to bring the downfall of the society. Well, look where it's led.
I know, showing your ankles has led to vibrators and internet porn, so yeah. Yay for showing your ankles. Yeah, Charlie, you've had your hand up for like a million years.
Yeah, so I have a quick observation and a quick question. The observation is that a crackdown doesn't have to be arresting millions of people. There was a case some years ago where there was a couple that had a BBS. They were having sex on the camera or whatever, or showing pictures of it. Some postal inspector somewhere saw this and, you know, he was like in a different state from them, but he went after them and prosecuted them, and I think they're still in prison. They appealed, but they got a long, long, long prison term.
Yeah, and there was actually recent case in Massachusetts, what people call it Paddleboro or something.
Yeah, that wasn't
like
an internet-related thing.
It wasn't
the point
internet,
is you only need a few, one or two prosecutions like that, and it scares the shit out of everybody else. My question is, I was wondering if you could talk some about intelligent vibrators that use neurofeedback in order to monitor people's responses, and I just thought I'd change the subject. Because you wanted to talk about women's orgasms and scanning and stuff, so I thought you could talk about intelligent
Charlie's
vibrators.
Charlie's trying to be my plant. okay, intelligent vibrators. Well, so I think I know what Charlie's asking about, the neurofeedback vibrator. Yeah, so basically in the course of researching this article on female orgasms for Wired, I discovered that there was this researcher at Rutgers in New Jersey who's working on a neurobiofeedback fMRI machine, which is a huge way of saying basically a machine that you can go inside and it will image your brain. It'll do an MRI scan of your brain and then feed it back to you in almost real time so that you can be watching the pattern of your thoughts in your brain as you're thinking them. They have a 10-second delay, so it's not perfect. But the way an MRI works is that it measures basically oxygen levels and blood levels in your brain, and so the idea is that it looks at active and inactive parts. So the active parts of your brain are the ones that are, you know, obviously where you're thinking physically, where that's what they hope. So in the process of doing experiments on what's happening in women's brains when they're orgasming, this doctor, Dr. Barry Komisarek, is hoping that he can help train women to have better orgasms, because as they masturbate in these machines, these giant MRI machines, through a rather complicated process, actually, because they can't have the women move, so they have to have women who can think off, basically, who can have orgasms just by sort of squeezing their muscles and doing, like, breathing and stuff. So the women have orgasms, and then they watch what's happening in their brain while it's going on and learn, and it's like biofeedback. And so the hope that this guy Komisarek has, and there's no reason to think that he's wrong since he's built the damn machine. So if any of you can think off, I'll give you his email if you want to try the machine. He needs more subjects. So the idea is that you could slowly train yourself to have more massive orgasms by trying to enhance the blood flow to certain parts of the brain that are activated when you have an orgasm.
This is a massively subversive technology that must be stopped, because if women can learn to have orgasms completely by thinking, men will become obsolete.
It's much more fun when you have a partner to watch, though.
So how do I get funding for this stuff?
First, get a PhD. it's really quite interesting, a lot of the research on female orgasms, because what the researchers have learned is that the female orgasm is much more in the brain than it is in the genitals. And so, for example, that's why Viagra doesn't work on women as well as it does on men, because men apparently have a much greater association between genital arousal and feeling aroused mentally. Like, so a man will have an erection and you ask him, do you feel aroused? And generally he'll say yes. Whereas if a woman has similar genital signs of arousal, like she's wet or swollen, and you ask her, are you aroused? 50% of the time she'll say, nah. Or she might say yes. So there's less of a connection, even if you appear to be aroused. You may not actually feel aroused if you're a woman, and vice versa too. So there were tests that they did where women just appeared physically not aroused at all, and then they would report, yeah, I'm totally horny. So that's why all of these researchers are now fascinated by what's happening in women's brains when they're having orgasms, because they'd love to develop a drug, of course, that would be kind of like Viagra for the brain. So you take the drug and like get have an orgasm, basically. I mean, that's what they're hoping for. That's what I'm hoping for, anyway. Yeah, someone just asked, isn't that pot? apparently, pot is not across the board an orgasm-causing drug. So,
haven't they developed a new chocolate that's supposed to add the endorphins and make the simulation of?
I haven't heard that. Yeah, I haven't heard of. Yeah, wow, well, the chocolate orgasm. Everybody knows the chocolate is already an aphrodisiac, so that'd be great.
This is extended. It's like 100 times more than what chocolate is.
100 times more.
give you a heart attack. I had a comment, but I just also wanted to comment on that what you were just talking about, the MRI and the feedback, that is just totally fascinating to me. I actually have like a 3 or 4 years experience doing not biofeedback, but it's like it's almost like meditation, but it's this whole series of things that I can do really just with my mind, and almost like biofeedback, but it's like totally mental in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just really fascinated on that, and I told you I'd email you anyways, but I want to send you the article where I explain like what I'm doing, because it's really similar except without the big, you know, $1 million machine. the comment I originally wanted to make is that everyone kept talking about, you know, the government, and you know, the government, you know, is gonna get you in trouble, but it's not necessarily just the government. It's like private individuals can, you know, look up your, you know, track you down and find you, or groups, or, you know, conservative organizations could, like, decide that, you know, they wanted to point you out or ostracize you or come after you or send you hate mail or threaten you. You know, all kind, they come after you. It doesn't have to be the government, which is like the them. Mm-hmm. It could be some other.
It could be
group.
Activist groups. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
It's just the same way that they people like stalk down doctors who perform abortions. I mean, they have means and they will do things to achieve their aim, and yeah, they don't have to be the government.
I think that's true, and I think my fear, even though, you know, like I said, I'm glad that people are optimistic, and I'm happy if we all sort of, if everybody's sort of feeling like, yay, we're more sexually enlightened, and we're getting more sex and more enlightenment, that's great, but I do worry that all you need, as Charlie was pointing out, are a couple of high-profile prosecutions, you know, either, you know, prosecutions by the government in court or by activist groups who are targeting people for violence or for just, you know, picketing in front of their house. And that scares a lot of people off. You know, again, there's certain hardcore, you know, sex activists who are never going to be scared and who are going to fight to the bitter end and be like, here's my pussy on screen. Yeah. You know, yay for those people. Yeah. But for the rest of us who may not be as, like, you know, hardcore about it, you know, I think that there is a real concern that those people will be scared off, and that the sort of sense of impending doom or the sense that they may be prosecuted in some way or persecuted will scare them off from exploring sexuality online or displaying their sexuality online. So, yeah.
Well, one of the things I'm concerned about is that you can no longer see my pussy online thanks to certain regulations. One of the sites I was on closed due to the regulations, and one thing I wanted to note was that GLBT, queer, female-run sites with folks with different body looks, are getting shut down because they can't fight it and the big industry can. So that's something to certainly keep in mind with the administration.
Yeah, so what you get in that case, and we were talking about this on the 2257 panel, is you may not get all pornography stamped out, but you get a lot of the alternative pornography, a lot of the alternative imagery. So all you get is this kind of, you know, vivid video or Playboy-style porn, which gets back to the PV sex stuff. So it's like you get the PV sex, and you get the really standard bodies, you know, women look a certain way and men look a certain way, and there's not a lot of ways for us to see ourselves in that kind of representation, and it certainly doesn't allow for a lot of these things that we're talking about with minority sex communities finding each other to play with balloons or whatever, just to pick on the balloon people some more. Yay for the balloon people.
All right. I am one of the balloon people.
Really?
I gotta say this. Just because you keep using it as the example, that is me. But I'm really disturbed by the level that cautionary seems to be going beyond into frightening people off. Yes, there are going to be cases where people get outed, even cases where they lose jobs or get thrown in jail, but they're always a tiny minority. Yes, it's going to cause a chilling effect, but if we sit here in this room, if the EFF says, I want to make sure people understand there is the possibility of these dire consequences. Okay, it's true, but we're causing our own chilling effect. We've got to look towards the longer term. Everybody has to understand their own risks and their own risk tolerance, but we should not discourage people from doing the right things because there are other people out there who may react the wrong way.
I absolutely 100% agree with you, and I don't want to discourage people from exploring sexuality online. I don't want to discourage people from making pornography, from consuming pornography. What I do want, though, is exactly what you're saying, is for people to understand the risk. And I think that's particularly important when there is a widespread myth that when you're on the internet, you're anonymous and you're in private. And I think people don't understand that there are very simple technological means for finding out who they are. And I think in the same way that when a lot of people who go to sex parties who are fairly liberated and we want to encourage them to do that, you know, oftentimes they don't use their real names because they want to preserve their anonymity, and we respect that. Again, I want people to be able to have that option when they go online. And so, again, I want, I, certainly I, you know, I and, you know, I I don't know that the EFF has a position on sort of telling people to look at pornography, but certainly we have a position on free speech and free expression, and we're very much in favor of free sexual expression, and we believe that, you know, it's absolutely, you know, something that should be encouraged, and we fight to prevent the curtailing of that right. But again, we want people to be aware of the risk. So, you know, as long as people are having, like I said, having safe internet sex in the sense that they know what the risks are and they're protecting themselves, yes, have lots of sex online. put your pussy on the web. Again, I don't think that's an official EFF position, but.
Okay, so earlier you were talking about Tor, which is an awesome tool for enhancing your privacy. And
Yay, Tor.
So I remember, I don't know if it was this year or last year, but there was a case where the court said that because the guy was using PGP, that was enough evidence for them to seize his computer and inspect it. So of course they found child pornography, but not everyone who's using, you know, PGP is a child pornographer. So
that's right.
Are you guys afraid that at some point, like if they see that you're using a tool that does, you know, enhance your security, does that start to look like an indication of guilt? And you know, what can you do to prevent that?
Yeah, no, we are. That's something that we are very, very concerned about. And actually, we have a couple of FAQs up on the website that specifically deal with a lot of these legal implications of Tor. So if you're interested in a kind of a detailed answer, if you go to tor.eff.org, we have those up there. And, you know, a more pragmatic answer is if that happens to somebody who is using Tor, we want them to call us right away. And we are going to do everything we can to get to either represent them ourselves or get them representation that they can afford, because it's absolutely unconstitutional to be prosecuting people purely on the basis of using tools that are protecting their anonymity. As you all probably know, the First Amendment has been frequently interpreted by the Supreme Court to be a protection not only for free speech but free anonymous speech. So simply using a tool that makes you an anonymous speaker is your right under the First Amendment. So it is unconstitutional to stop you from doing that. So we're going to, like, fight those fuckers. Again, not an official EFF term.
How do you think the TCPA Palladium movement will affect pornography?
That's an interesting one. I suppose. To the extent that people want to lock up their porn with DRM, it'll just simply enhance their ability to do that. There is one porn site, Perfect 10, which is particularly litigious about its copyrights. It's the only adult website that I am aware of that has ever really seem to do very much in that arena in terms of just being very litigious about its IP, its intellectual property.
ASL.
I'm sorry?
There was a company called ASL a few years ago that did the same thing. They were very, someone had posted their copyrighted material to a news group. And
ASL. That's like the Perfect 10 case, yeah. I don't know about that case, but yeah, so it's relatively unusual. I don't see it as being a particularly huge issue, although, I mean, it kind of would go more into just the general problem with any kind of media that has DRM on it. To the extent that you want to make fair use of your porn, you know, having a trusted computing platform will be basically will not allow you to make fair use of your porn. And like any other kind of copyrighted material, pornography is also subject to the exemptions of fair use. So trusted computing, not good for media in general, I would say, porn included. So.
There was a question before about, well, what if they prosecute me just for using Tor? Before, I was the one saying, let's not be too alarmist. Now I'm going to turn around and be alarmist.
You're just going to be contrary.
Sometimes I
no, go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
It is unconstitutional for the government to go after somebody simply because they have technology which can protect them, at least as of today and the way the Constitution is currently interpreted.
Yes.
They don't have to go after you because you have Tor. They can go after you because you refuse to give them the keys to your encrypted hard disk or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, under the paranoia of the past 4 years, they actually can chuck you in jail for that. It can still
yes.
be challenged on constitutional grounds, but that law is presently written and to a certain degree being used. So I will point out a caution there where before I was telling people not to be too cautious.
Well, I think there are two different issues, though. There's one issue, which is, will you be prosecuted just for using Tor? The other issue is, will you be prosecuted if you're served with a subpoena or a warrant, some kind of court order, and you refuse to hand over information?
And what I'm suggesting is that they're not going to prosecute you and say your crime is using Tor. They're going to prosecute.
Yeah, they're
going to
ask you for information.
Else.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Well, the thing that's nice about Tor, at least that particular tool, and it's not true with necessarily with other privacy-enhancing tools, is that there really is nothing for you to hand over. So it will be lawful for you to say, "Okay, you've served me with a subpoena, but I have nothing. Like, I'm just a conduit." So that's one of the reasons why EFF is working with the developers of Tor, because we think it's a really sweet spot in the law. It's a really great anonymity-enhancing tool, and it's relatively resistant to those kinds of legal attacks.
Make very sure that Tor cannot be in any way interpreted to violate any of the provisions of Patriot or other laws that would require you to keep an audit trail.
Believe me, we have lawyers working on that. we have a team of about 5 lawyers who are constantly lawyering Tor, one of whom is a Patriot expert. So yeah, there really is, it's we've looked at it up and down, it's pretty foolproof. So and so far we've had we've had some takedown orders, but they haven't panned out, so.
I just wanted to comment on the comment you made a couple times back. I think it was when you were being more optimistic about people letting the possibility of, you know, prosecution or getting in trouble stop them from, you know, going out and doing what they want to do because, you know, so-and-so got prosecuted or these little cases to scare them off. But I just wanted to point out that it really is that kind of behavior that you see people doing, that, you know, that they're really overcautious, is the fact that we've got, like, you know, human psychology, which is hardwired from, you know, thousands and thousands of years facing the modern world, where because of the media, because of the internet, because of TV, you hear about these cases and you hear about people across the world and horrible things that happen to them. That it didn't happen in your hometown, it didn't happen in your state, it happened 5,000 miles away, but you're still going to be cautious about it. And this has to do, I mean, of course, with the entire phenomena of people being really concerned about crime and personal safety, and I think, identity theft or anything, because it might be a relatively small number of people who get in trouble or die, or whatever it is, but the human psychology is, they're seeing it on TV, it's an immediate thing, they have a reaction to it that it could happen to them, even though, like, there really is contextually no relationship between you and somebody, you know, in India that this happened to. It's almost like it's a myth that builds in your mind, because the human psychology was based on being afraid of things in the immediate environment, and it seems immediate, but it's really not.
Yeah, I guess that is why it's important to go the optimistic route a little bit and say, like, here is an example of a porn site that exists and hasn't, you know, the people who run it have encountered no problems and it's perfectly legal, and, you know, and here's, you know, 20 other sites just like it. So it is important to remember that for every, you know, one site or one person or one group that gets prosecuted or persecuted, there's so many others that are coming in to take their place and are coming in and being brave and sexy and using technology in that way.
Are these prosecutions occurring under the FCC?
No. FCC only deals with issues around decency, not obscenity.
I thought it was offensiveness. I mean, I thought basically the FCC has this really strange way of doing business where, Like if you say fuck on the radio, they don't do anything until somebody writes them a letter saying this is offensive.
That has to do, yeah, so that has to do with a set of laws that are, they're called decency laws, yeah, as opposed to obscenity laws, which have to do with generally with just sexuality. And the reason why FCC has those regulations is because certain communications channels like television and radio have been deemed significantly public, and that they are something that comes into homes relatively unfiltered, and so children will be exposed to them on a regular basis, and that's why there's a higher bar in terms of what you're allowed to say.
They're talking about expanding this to cable and satellite now, and if they
are.
Go to that.
And they're also with the CDA, the Communications Decency Act, Congress did try to spread it to the internet as well, but the decency provisions were struck down, so we don't have decency laws on the internet right now.
In the case of that couple on the BBS, it was a postal inspector who prosecuted them.
It was because they were sending it through the mails.
Where the transaction took place and whose laws applied.
Yeah. So, but we still have obscenity laws that apply to the internet, and the obscenity laws cover only a very small area.
The thing about that is you always hear about people, the FCC responds to people who claim to be offended by things, and you never hear about somebody writing to the FCC and saying, I'm offended by what you did. You know, you fined this guy for saying fuck on the radio. I find that a lot more offensive. You know, that you would put somebody in jail or something.
I do too. Yeah, it'd be great if you could fine the FCC every time they have been.
Well, no, but they're supposed to take action based on our opinions, you know? Mm-hmm. That's the whole idea. So if you write them and say that you find their behavior offensive or something, shouldn't that carry the same weight as, you know, a fundamentalist in Mississippi who doesn't like Howard Stern?
Well, unfortunately, that's not the way that the decency laws work. So, yeah, the decency laws do cover very specific kinds of expression. So you can't just say this, because what the FCC is doing is political, right? So you can't say your political activity, which is within the law, offends me, therefore dock yourself $5 or $100 or whatever. Although that would be, you know, I'm sure many people would enjoy doing that, but...
Respond to this last gentleman's comment about why don't people say it offends me when you find someone for something like that? Why don't people get up and say, well, indecency laws offend me, anti-pornography laws offend me because you're keeping me from my porn, damn it. I mean, why don't people do things like that? Well, it's not that they can't. I mean, no. They can. It just isn't always something that they're willing to risk. I mean, I'm more open than most people I know when I discuss my relationship with pornography. Pretty much everybody I know uses pornography and enjoys it to some extent or another, but people are always like, I can't believe you just openly talk about this all the time. I can't believe that told somebody you've got 85 gigs of porn on your hard drive. I mean, but I've got a small hard drive, but...
people are already criticizing the size of his porn collection. Give me a break.
but
mine's bigger than yours.
But these are people that, you know, they enjoy porn every bit as much as I do, but they don't talk about it. They don't want people knowing. And if somebody in front of them is being accused of being a, you know, you dirty, filthy son of a bitch, you have porn, blah, 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 and they're just being drugged down by the masses, these people are not going to step forward. Because it's hardwired into their brains, both from fear of social repercussions and the fact that whenever they were raised at some time or another, they were raised to believe that this was naughty, that this was bad, that it's not something you're supposed to talk about or confess to doing if you do. Right. You know, that's absolutely right.
I think that is what's so great about the sort of flourishing of pornography and sex information on the internet is that there is a counter message, right? I mean, so we have the one message that you're talking about, which says porn is unspeakable, your sexual desires are foul. But then there's a counter message, which is coming from all these happy people online who are like, yay, sex with balloons. And, you know, and that's a very, yes, thank you. Coming right from right here in this room. And that is a very powerful message because there are many, many voices that are speaking that message too. So I think that people are able to get another story from going online. And you know, it may not be something that they hear in their communities in real life, but they are seeing communities online where they can be open.
I live in a very small town in Texas, 2,500 people. I'm a full hour away from the nearest 24-hour convenience store. I mean, I am in the boonies. But I know personally, you know, people that I'm friends with know fewer than five people that regularly post photos on adult websites, their own photos. And one couple that I knew personally recently got in a lot of trouble because they were running their own webcam site, and the people in town found out about it. Both of them lost their jobs. They were just, no questions asked, booted from their jobs, and pretty much became pariahs within the town. I would have liked nothing better, you know, than to have stood up on the street wearing a sign, you know, "You are all bastards. You know, these people are your friends, they're your family, you've known them for years, and they weren't breaking any laws." But, you know, like I said, I'm a school teacher. I would have, you know, I would have been right there in the fire with them in half a second.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, that's the kind of example that we're talking about where, you know, not being cautious led these people into, you know, being recognized by their community and being ostracized. So, you know, I mean, that's sort of the dark side of all of this public sexuality online. But please say something optimistic, Balloon Guy.
Well, this is one of those cases. This is one of those cases where, as much as I've always been opposed to forcible outing of anybody, if you've got actual evidence rather than simple knowledge of maybe one or two high-profile citizens or something like that, this is one of those cases where you forcibly out people because they're being fucking hypocrites. And it may not happen in this particular case in your particular town, but over the course of human evolution, and really, we got to understand, we're talking mostly about North America here because we're much more screwed up than some other parts of the world.
Yeah, and well, we're talking about our laws, too.
Yes.
So.
When one of these things happens, if there are enough people who know each other and will all agree to step forward at once, or if somebody has the goods on enough people and outs them all at once, it becomes much harder for anyone to maintain this enforced pariah status on the others, because
of course,
they aren't pariahs.
Of course, if our community of internet porn aficionados takes that position, then again, we're creating our own chilling effect because people are going to be less likely to engage in sexual expression online if they're worried that their own, you know, community online is going to out them if something like this happens. Like, what if somebody took that position and had outed our friend back there and had said, "Well, one of the school teachers likes porn in the town, so why are you, why are you persecuting these other people?" So then, if he's worried that that's going to happen all the time, you know, how likely is it that he's going to share all of his, you know, what was it, 85 gigabytes or something?
85 gigs of porn. Yes. And I agree that that would be, I would love it if that were true and if we could do that quite simply through outing. But I mean, look at all the people who have been outed. Like, remember like the Jim Baker scandal? You know, it's like, that doesn't mean that evangelical Christians are now viewed as frauds and hypocrites. It just, by us in this room. Okay. By people who appreciate balloon fetishism. But, you know, I mean, no, I mean, No. I already talked about mind control porn, okay? you know, if you didn't get the hint after like six references. so, you know, no, I mean, and I appreciate balloon fetishists. I'm just saying that, you know, we're kind of outliers on the spectrum. So, you know, I wish that were true, but I do think that, I don't know. I mean, outing is one of those things where I think it's a gray area. Like, it can be helpful. Like, there was the case of the politician in Seattle who was, like, rabidly anti-gay. And actually, as much as I think outing is problematic, I was really psyched when they.
He was the mayor, right?
Yeah. He was the mayor, and he was, you know, doing. Yeah, it was somewhere in Washington, and he was doing a lot of anti-gay legislation, and a local right-wing paper did a huge investigation where they basically for about a year were pretending they had a guy who was pretending to be a teenage boy who was flirting with the mayor online, and finally got the mayor to admit during a chat session who he was, and you know got all of it you know saved to disk and. And they got him. They basically outed him as this gay guy who was going after high school boys online, and that was great. I mean, so that's an example where it worked.
It must be used pedophile. Very carefully.
Yeah, exactly. It has to be done very carefully. And in this case, yeah, there's also the added problem of the pedophilia, which you know. I think we need to wrap up. So does anybody have like a final comment or question or? Explanation. Interrogation.
Are you Betty White 14, just out of
curiosity? No. I don't even know what that question meant, but I do know the answer is no. Well, I guess like I'll give us a little take-home message, just like they used to have at the end of Red Shoe Diaries. So we were talking about that earlier at dinner. How like every, I don't know if you guys watched Red Shoe Diaries, but it was this really cheesy like erotica show, and at the end of every episode they'd have a little warm moment.
David Duchovny would explain the moral to his dog.
David Duchovny would explain the moral to his dog. Yes, Charlie's right. So at any rate, so I think the moral is that basically you know, sex you know, we've used technology a great deal to learn about sex and express ourselves sexually, and you know, certainly the communications technologies like the internet have greatly expanded our ability to learn about sex and also understand that there's a huge amount of sex that goes on that's far beyond the sort of mainstream PV sexuality, and that you know, but at the same time, you know, cautionary note, you know, you're not in private on the internet, you're not anonymous, so, you know, be careful what you're doing out there. Be careful out there, but have lots of sex. And express yourself about it a lot.
Okay, I just wanted to say before we all leave, obviously, just step out the door there. There's a whole lot of sex at this convention, but I just want to thank Annalee for, you know, getting really to the heart of the matter, because we talked about things that people really just don't talk about here at the convention, despite the fact that we're just practically inundated with sexual messages from you know, one hall to another. So thank you so much.
Thanks again.